Becoming a Friend of Jesus is the theme of our service this morning, and what our weekly faith stories are really all about. This morning's faith story presenter is Jack Laughlin.
If you've never experienced an authentic relationship, how easy would it be to come into relationship with God? From the outside, my family looked like everyone else's family. From the inside, however, we played roles, not real people. My family was missing a key ingredient. There was no emotional connection between us. When I look today and see children going to their parents for a hug or attention, I am amazed at this because I have no memories of ever doing this growing up. As a result, I grew up learning not how to need anybody, to be self-sufficient, and the result was anger and rebellion to any authority. This lack of connection, this lack of intimacy, made it very difficult for me to establish any meaningful relationship as I grew older. Whenever a relationship would take a natural course to grow closer, I would leave. I wanted to be with someone, but feared anything that would take me out of my own control. I feared real relationships. Getting close felt unsafe. I needed autonomy to feel normal. After many failed relationships, including divorce, I reached an end to rationalizing my failures. I let my pain loose and wept for the first time in my life. It was winter. I was alone and hurting. I desperately needed some answers and didn't know the questions to ask, and that was scary for someone who held control so selfishly tight to himself. Not really knowing what to expect, I went outside, knelt down in the snow, and surrendered myself to God and asked for help. Strangely, at the time, I didn't know God personally or even what would happen if I trusted him. I soon found myself in church where I met Donna. She had been a believer for 5 years and was solidly grounded in her faith. She shared with me who Jesus Christ was and how he invites us to commit our lives to him. You would think this would be a simple act for me since I was searching spiritually, but being a rebellious person, I wrestled with this decision for some time. I read the book of John in the New Testament and learned what it meant to ask Jesus for forgiveness and for him to come into my life. It meant I would have to completely trust him to come into a relationship with him. I spent many sleepless nights fearing this potential loss of control. Finally, I knew that if I truly wanted a meaningful relationship with anyone, it had to start with Jesus first. I knew he would be there for me, so I surrendered my life to Jesus on an Ash Wednesday worship service. I experienced what felt like a river rush through me from the top to bottom in a way that only God could craft to let me know for sure that a change had happened. I became a big sponge, soaking up all the information I could learn about what it meant to be a Christian. I began to finally understand the Bible and was overjoyed at realizing that what I was reading was God's truth. I joined Bible study fellowship and practically cried the first night I heard 500 men sing a hymn. I just didn't think men did this. I also learned and joined a small group of men where it was required to meet with another man for a year in a covenant relationship. We would meet once a week to discuss our journey. After 2 years, I called Wooddale and asked if there would be another man I could meet with, an experienced Christian that could disciple me. I was linked to one of the strongest men of faith I could possibly meet, Bob Kinzora. Bob had become a believer in a big way himself, having been a cop in Chicago, and then changed careers to become a missionary in South America. His role at Wooddale was to befriend those that had experienced divorce. He also loved to take long, relaxing motorcycle rides with his wife, Judy. Bob sensed what I needed and led me through a book on becoming a Christian man. His experiences and his own example of living taught me volumes. He connected with me man to man in a way I had never known before. Years later, I am finally ready to become a discipler myself. I discovered the Discipling 101 course and finally feel open to let Jesus work through me. I still don't have all the right answers, but I know where to look and am ready to connect with anyone courageous enough to start a real relationship. It's just one way I can thank Bob. I married Donna. I bought a motorcycle myself. If Bob were alive, I'd hope he'd be proud.
My family moved twice during my growing up years, when I was in the first grade and when I was in the seventh grade. Changing homes and changing schools was difficult, but I think the hardest part of all was making friends. We had lived in a larger city and moved to a town with a population of 5,000, with a school system that only went up to the eighth grade. And virtually everyone in my seventh grade class had known each other all of their lives. And I was new and not part of, well, I just wanted to make friends. And I'm not sure I really knew how. And we all need friends, you know? I mean, even Jesus needed friends. Not just a crowd of thousands of people that would applaud him, but friends who would like him for who he is. He wanted other men to hang out with, to relax with, to just be friends. And so you know that he chose a dozen disciples. We sometimes call them apostles or saints. And their names are familiar. Names like Peter and Andrew and James. And we've wondered what it must have been like for those who were so specially close to Jesus. But we rarely think of it from Jesus' side of the relationship. We kind of imagine that Jesus was sort of like the coach of a Division I NCAA team, and he was trying to pick a bunch of winners that would take him to the championship, or that he was the president of a Fortune 100 company and wanted the best of a management team. He was looking for people who would write his Bible, who would tell his gospel, who would build his church. But might we also think that he was simply a 30-something guy from a town of 500 named Nazareth who simply wanted to make friends? So we go back to a day when Jesus was alone and perhaps lonely. Some say that loneliness is a universal human experience. For some more, for some less, but everybody at one point or another in life is lonely. And that Jesus was not exempt from those feelings. Loneliness is that sense that you're completely on your own, that you can't turn to anyone else. It's a sense of isolation, and sometimes loneliness can be absolutely crushing, lasting either for a few moments or for some of us lasting for years and much of a lifetime. Loneliness does not always come in the times of desperation and difficulty. Loneliness can also come at those times when we are euphoric, when we have great successes, when things are going exceptionally well, but it seems like no one else understands. Maybe it was a combination of all of those. One day when Jesus was teaching in the synagogue, and as a boy he had grown up in the synagogue, so it was an honored and honorable thing for him to that day teach. I would expect that his heart was pumping with the excitement of that opportunity. But then there were critics in the congregation, critics who confronted him over a very fine point of Jewish law. For there was that day at the synagogue a man who had a disabled right hand, and they saw what was coming, that Jesus was going to use his supernatural power to heal that man. And his critics insisted that it wasn't right to do that on the Sabbath day because it could wait until the next morning. And Jesus decided to go ahead and do it anyway. He concluded that it was the right thing to do, and they were so outraged that they began to conspire against him. And as much as we may want to say that Jesus did what was right, the truth of it is that for him and for all of us, it is difficult to have critics and to have those who disapprove of what we have done. And so Jesus went away to be by himself, to put his head and perspective together. His biographer, Luke, says in Luke 6:12 that Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, and he spent the night praying to God. We're not told the content of that all-night prayer, although it is interesting and informative that Jesus, as a first resort in the midst of loneliness, went to God the Father, not as a last resort. That in the busyness of schedule, when he needed his sleep, he stayed up all night and gave a priority to prayer. And we are not told what was said, what he asked of his father, or what his father advised him to do. Although I think we can surmise from the context that precedes and follows, we know what Jesus next did, and so we can at least guess on what that prayer conversation may have been like. That Jesus was saying, I'm alone, and I'm burdened by all I have to do, and I'm exhilarated by the success of the healing, but discouraged by the critics around me. Father, what should I do? The Father says, Jesus, if you're going to fulfill your purpose in life, if you're going to make it, if you're going to deal with the highs and the lows, you can't do this alone. What you need to do is get some friends. So it was a father telling his son, go and make some friends. And so biographer Luke goes on to say that when morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, his brother Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. So out of this crowd of people that were interested in Jesus, he chose 12 to be his friends. Choosing friends is a risky thing to do, because if you pick a friend, that person may not reciprocate and may not want to be your friend. Or you may choose a friend with the hope that that person will meet your needs and will take care of you, only to discover that the person that you have chosen is more needy than you are. And that friendship is kind of a one-way thing, and you're now actually servicing that person that you thought would energize you. So friends can help, but friends can also hurt. There is always a risk that goes with friendship. But Jesus was willing to take that risk. And he selected a dozen. There's nothing magical about the number 12. Some would say, well, that's significant among Jews because there were 12 sons to the patriarch Jacob, or the 12 territorial tribes of Israel. But it could just be that there were 12 because there were 12. Whatever the reason and whatever the number, it's a lot, actually, for friends. Most of us would consider it a good deal to have a few friends, a handful of really close friends, and to have a dozen, that is unusual, if not exceptional. Oh, in some ways, they weren't a very diverse lot. When you first read the list, you say that if they were all together in a lineup, I'm not sure I could distinguish one of them from the other. They were all men. Although Jesus did have an unusual number of women friends in his larger circle of relationships, they were all Jewish. 11 of the 12 of them were from the province of Galilee, where Jesus grew up and considered to be home. One of them was from the province of Judea, where Jesus had been born. They had a lot in common, probably similar in age. But when you start to inspect, you discover that there were differences among them. First on the list was Simon, who was a fisherman. He was a born natural leader. He was loud and in your face and impulsive, very different from Jesus. But you know, sometimes we choose friends who are not much like us, actually a contrast rather than a likeness. Second on the list was Andrew. Andrew was the brother of Simon, but he wasn't much like Simon. He was a softer spirit. He shared in the family fishing business on Galilee Lake, but actually he had more of a, I don't know, spiritual inquiry or bent to him. So he took a sabbatical from the fishing business And he went chasing after this kind of tempestuous prophet, John the Baptizer, went out to see him and listen to him in the desert, and was attracted to him, but John the Baptizer pointed Andrew to Jesus. And when he met Jesus, one of the first things he did was to go and to recruit his brother Simon and introduce Simon and Jesus to each other. It was an amazing moment, the beginning of a stunning relationship that was to last for a lifetime. Third and fourth on the list were James and John. They also were brothers. So of the first four friends, they were from two families. But James and John, they were not much like Peter and Andrew. For one thing, they had a lot more money. They were from the family of Zebedee, an upper middle class family that owned two homes, one up north in Galilee and the other down south in Jerusalem. Their family was connected politically and religiously, and they knew the leaders of Israel in their generation. Fifth on the list was Philip. Philip was from the same hometown as Simon and Andrew, Bethsaida. And it was a little town, so being of similar age, they would have known each other all of their lives. Philip, kind of interesting, because that's a Greek name in a Jewish context and culture. Not impossible, but it's a little bit like Mohammed at the synagogue or Sven in a Chinese restaurant. It can be done. It can be done, but it is a little bit surprising to find Philip here. And then there's Bartholomew. Do you know there are in the biographies of Jesus many different lists of his disciples, of his friends, and often the lists are not complete. They're not all dozen of them, but Bartholomew appears in every one of the lists. Besides that, we know nothing about him. Some friends are kind of invisible, but always there. And Bartholomew, to his credit, always showed up. And then there was Matthew, a tax collector. In all indications, a good and an honorable man in a profession that was often maligned. So he knew all the tax collector jokes. He could finish them before you barely started them. And he knew all of the harassment that went along with his profession. Next was Thomas. Thomas was a twin. Now that's curious, isn't it? Because Jesus chose brothers, but didn't choose the other twin to be counted among his best friends. James, the son of Alphaeus, well, we know that he had a mother who had the same name as Jesus' mother, Mary. It seems strange that Jesus chose another James. So he's got multiplication of names. And when they hung out together for 3.5 years, when he said James, there were two that turned their heads. So I'm sure that one was Jim or Jimmy. There must have been some other name that was given to him. And then as the list progresses, there's another Simon to add to the confusion. This one is Simon the Zealot, which is in modern times roughly equivalent to Bill the Democrat or George the Republican, because a zealot was a political party designation. And the zealots were right-wing nationalists to the core. Most of them carried a dagger or two hidden somewhere in their clothing, and many of them took vows that they would kill any Roman if ever the opportunity was provided. You could say that he was Simon the terrorist, because that's pretty much what zealots were. Understanding that terrorism is not something new to the Middle East in our generation, it is something that went back to virtually all the earlier generations, and that Jesus had one of the terrorists counted among his friends. The last two both have the name Judas. Judas, the son of James, is a virtual unknown. He did ask Jesus a question at the Last Supper. He had a nickname, and that was Thaddeus. And because of what happened with the other Judas, I think he preferred his nickname over being called Judas. But beyond that, we really don't know anything about him. And last on the list was Judas Iscariot. Of the 12, he's the only one that was not from Jesus' home province of Galilee. About his later life, we know much detail. About his early life, we know very little. But what we do know is that out of the large crowds of those who may have been candidates to be among Jesus' dozen friends, Judas Iscariot was considered one of the best. That he was good with numbers and he was notable for his trustworthiness. So that when Jesus had to pick someone who would be the treasurer of the group and take all of their pooled resources, the best choice was Judas Iscariot. There are some interesting, even curious things about this list of friends. Out of the 12, there were two named Simon, two named James, and two named Judas. It's almost like watching a George Foreman ad on television, you know, with all of his sons named George. And you begin to think, did they have a shortage of names in this generation? I mean, couldn't they have given them numbers or something that was different? And so Jesus gave them nicknames. It kind of gives you an insight into what Jesus was like, the way he loved nicknames and how often he used them. So he called Simon Peter, or in English, Rocky. James and John, he said that they were the sons of thunder. Thomas was nicknamed the twin. Judas, the son of James, was called Thaddeus. Matthew was nicknamed Levi. James, the son of Alphaeus, was called James the Lesser. How would you like that for your nickname, the Lesser? And in all probability, it was either because he was smaller than everybody else or that he was younger than everybody else. So he's one of those guys who went through adulthood always being called Junior, except they called him James the Lesser. And then there was Nathaniel. Nathaniel? That was a nickname too for one of them. But only the nickname is ever given. And so when Nathanael is mentioned in the biography of Jesus, we don't know exactly who Jesus was specifically referring to. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, they were all fishermen. 11 of these 12 died violent deaths. Judas, by suicide. James was assassinated by the sword under the rule of King Herod Agrippa in AD 44. Peter was crucified. Of the dozen, only one lived to old age and died of natural causes, and that was John. Some became famous, so famous, in fact, that there are many here today who are named after them. And others are just a name. We don't know much at all. Some were related. Out of the 12, there were three that were in the inner circle, sort of close friends among close friends. And out of the three in the inner circle, there was one who was Jesus' best friend, and that was John. These 12 became Jesus' delight. For more than 3 years, they walked and talked and slept and ate and took on critics, and they basked in the praise of crowds, and together they prayed and laughed and shopped and shared their lives. Because they were friends. You know, when you see a television interview of soldiers returning from this war or some other war that have been wounded or for some reason sent home, and they often say, I want to go back. And the primary reason, at least, seldom seems to be career or even patriotism. The usual reason that is given is, I want to return to my unit because I want to return to my friends. When the realities of life are shared together, there is a solidarity that links the souls. And that's the way it was with Jesus and with his friends. So for his delight, you can imagine the smile on Jesus' face that stormy day when he was walking on Galilee Lake and Peter was so excited that he jumped out of the boat and in an astonishing burst of faith, he walked on the water as well. Or think how it must have felt in Jesus' soul when these friends said, we will die for you rather than abandon you. And see the excitement that just oozes out of him when they come and say, Jesus, we've heard and seen you pray. Teach us to pray like that. And then they absorb every word to the point of memorization, and they repeat back, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. or grasp the significance of what it meant to Jesus when his own family came to get him because they said he was crazy out of his mind and they were going to take him back home and lock him up. But his 12 friends stood up for him and stuck with him. They were closer to him and better friends to him than even members of his own family. If you have very good friends, you know the delights that Jesus felt. But if you have very good friends, you also know that disappointment is often a part of friendship. Jesus disappointed these friends. They wanted him to use his supernatural powers in battle against the Romans and kick out the occupying army. And Jesus disappointed them by saying, "Blessed are the peacemakers." They came to him and said, "Call down fire from heaven on these villages that will not believe." And Jesus wouldn't do it. Two of them came and said, "We would like the positions of prominence, one on your right hand and the other on your left hand in your kingdom." And Jesus said, "That's not my position to give." And so as much as they admired him, they were often disappointed with him. And I try to imagine how Jesus felt in that, for it is a hard thing to disappoint your friends. It is a hard thing to say no to those that you really care about. And Jesus disappointed them. But they also disappointed Jesus. He taught them intensely about humility, and they responded with outbursts of pride. Jesus gave his special trust, his money, to Judas Iscariot. And Judas concluded it wasn't enough and sold Jesus out to add 30 more coins to the kitty. He asked them to pray for him when he was depressed and discouraged and suffering. And they fell asleep. And then when he was arrested, when he needed them maybe more than just about any other time, they were too scared, even though that they had promised that they would always stand by him. And there were only two that followed him to his trials, and one of them would have been better off if he had fled with the rest, because he ended up denying Jesus three times before the night was over. And when it came for the day when Jesus died, there was only one who showed up. You think about dying? I do. You wonder where you'll be and what it'll be like. But don't you, in your imagination, also think about those who will be by your side? And when you die, don't you want those that you love the most to be standing around your bed or closest to you? On the one day when Jesus most needed his friends to stick close, only John was there. I think we all know what it is like to disappoint others, and we all know what it is like to be disappointed. Maybe we don't all know what it's like to forgive and to be forgiven. It is amazing that Jesus was not going to allow these disappointments to fracture the friendships, but rather he was going to use these disappointments to strengthen their relationship. He wanted it to be stronger and lasting. He wanted them to be his friends for more than 3.5 years. He wanted them to be his friends forever. And so the very last line of Matthew's biography of Jesus says, "Surely I am with you always." Now, Matthew was one of the dozen friends, and he wrote this biography after Jesus had ascended back up to heaven. And he must have had 1,000 different alternatives of how to end the story. But he chose to quote these specific words from Jesus. Why? Because he didn't want it to be over. Because 3+ years of friendship was not enough. That he wanted Jesus there with him. And so he remembered and he wrote down and he claimed the words of Jesus that Jesus would always be with him. But why did Jesus say those words? Because Jesus wanted to be with his friends. Jesus didn't want it to be over either. He didn't want just 42 months of a relationship. He wanted it to last for all of eternity. He wanted them to be his friends forever. I told you that our family moved to a town of 5,000 when I was in the seventh grade. And I remember what it was like to walk to school alone. It wasn't very far, 10 minutes, 12 maybe. Only two different ways to go, and they were only about a few hundred yards difference in variety. I remember walking to school in the morning and then walking home by myself for lunch. And then after lunch, walking back to school again, just me. And then at the end of the day when the bell rang and friends were running out together to all of their plans, I walked home by myself. And it was lonely. And then one day, two other seventh graders who lived on my side of the village, Dave and Judy, came and said, "Do you want to walk home with us?" It was a memorable and transforming moment because it was about more than walking home. It was their way of saying, "We want to be your friends." Well, listen to this. Jesus wants to be our friends. He doesn't want us to ever have to walk alone. But it's more than his providing something to meet our need and satisfy our loneliness. It is that he wants to walk with us. It's that he wants to be our friend. He wants that. Be stunned by the words of Jesus recorded in John 15, where he says, "Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." And he says, "I have called you friends," and adds, "You did not choose me, I chose you." Jesus wanted us to be his friends. Jesus wants to make friends of you and me. So let's add our names to the list. It's no longer just 12, no longer just Peter and Andrew, but now it's Peter and Paul, and it's Andrew and Angie. It's James and John and Nathaniel and Naomi and Philip and Patty and Mary and Martha and Larry and Leif and your name too. Be the friend of Jesus Christ. God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, how happy we are that Jesus wants to be friends with us. May we be faithful friends to him as he is a faithful friend to us. We pray in our friend's name.